ज्ञानाञ्जनशलाकया चक्षुरुन्मीलितं येन तस्मै श्रीगुरवे नमः। श्रीचैतन्यामनोभीष्टं स्थापितं येन भूतले स्वयं रूपा कदा मह्यं ददाति स्वापदान्तिकम्। वन्देऽहं श्रीगुरो श्रीयुता पदकमलं श्रीगुरून् वैष्णवांश्च श्रीरूपां सागरजातं सहगणा रघुनाथान्वितं तं सजीवं साद्वैतं सावधूतं परिजनासहितं कृष्णचैतन्यदेवं श्रीराधाकृष्णपादां सहगणा ललिता श्रीविशाखान्वितांश्च। हे कृष्णा करुणा सिन्धो दीनबन्धो जगत्पते गोपेश गोपिकाकान्त राधाकान्त नमोऽस्तुते। तप्तकाञ्चन गौराङ्गी राधे वृन्दावनेश्वरी वृषभानुसुते देवी प्रणमामि हरिप्रिये। वाञ्छाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पावनेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। जय श्रीकृष्ण चैतन्य प्रभो नित्यानन्द श्री अद्वैतगदाधर श्रीवासादि गौरभक्तवृन्द। हरे कृष्णा कृष्ण कृष्ण हरे 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 राम 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 हरे हरे। सो टुडे आई थॉट वी कुड do a session, as I was mentioning yesterday, on Srimati Radharani, Krishna's dearest devotee and internal energy, because the Nectar of Instruction spends quite a bit of time discussing Srimati Radharani and her beloved pond, Kunda, named Radha Kunda. And just as the association of devotees is a very persistent theme in the Nectar of Instruction, as we discussed last time. Another very persistent theme that you find occurring over several verses is the glorification of Sri Vrindavan Dham and the residents of Vrindavan who worship Krishna in the mood of spontaneous love, and the mode of worship which follows in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan. So this is kind of the three-part conception of this seminar, that kind of one major theme as being the self-control, both through personal means, in terms of internally our own qualities, and also social means. So kind of the first part of this seminar, we discussed the social aspects of self-control, and how these boundaries can be very useful in the form of vows, and also in terms of one's own personal good qualities like determination and so forth. And then the second aspect of it is not just then one's own personal boundaries, but how do we relate to others? Right? How do we express our Krishna consciousness in relation to devotees? And so starting from oneself, then expanding out to the Vaishnava community in terms of what is association. And that was kind of the second part that we did yesterday afternoon. And then the third part, which is today, has to do with kind of the ultimate goal, the type of association we're ultimately aspiring for, which is with devotees who worship Krishna in the mood of the residents of Vrindavan, so that we too can develop that mode of service. So let me begin first by reading one of the relevant verses from the Nectar of Instruction. This is verse number 10, and we'll read a section of that purport.
Mm-hmm.
Karmebhya parito hare priyataya vyaktim yayur jnanina tebhyo jnana vimukta bhakti parama premaika nishthastata tebhya tapashupalakam kajadrishas tabhyo pisaradhika prishtha tadvadiyam tadiya sarasi Translation for Prabhupada's Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Prabhupada. In the Shastra, it is said that of all types of fruit of workers, he who is advanced in knowledge of the higher values of life is favored by the Supreme Lord Hari. Out of many such people who are advanced in knowledge, jnanis, one who is practically liberated by virtue of his knowledge may take to devotional service. He is superior to the others. However, one who has actually attained prema, pure love of Krishna, is superior to him. The gopis are exalted above all the advanced devotees because they are always totally dependent upon Sri Krishna, the transcendental cowherd boy. Among the gopis, Srimati Radharani is the most dear to Krishna. Her kunda, lake, is as profoundly dear to Lord Krishna as this most beloved of the gopis. Who then will not reside at Radha Kunda and in a spiritual body surcharged with ecstatic devotional feelings, aprakrita bhava, render loving service to the divine couple, Sri Radha Govinda, who perform their Ashtakaliya Lila, their eternal eightfold daily pastimes. Indeed, those who execute devotional service on the banks of Radha Kunda are the most fortunate people in the universe. And for the purport, let's begin. I encourage all of you to read this book thoroughly and completely. And I know some of you are taking a Bhakti Shastri course with Nilamani Prabhu, so I'm sure you are. It would be wonderful to read this whole purport, but in the interest of time, let's begin on page 87. The second paragraph, it says, after taking to devotional service, if you're following along, otherwise you can listen. Page 87. After taking to devotional service under the regulative principles, a person may come to the platform of spontaneous love of Godhead, following in the footsteps of great devotees like Narada and Sanaka and Sanatana. The Supreme Personality of Godhead then recognizes him to be superior. The devotees who have developed love of Godhead are certainly in an exalted position. Of all these devotees, the gopis are recognized as superior because they do not know anything other than satisfying Krishna. Nor do the gopis expect any return from Krishna. Indeed, sometimes Krishna puts them into extreme suffering by separating himself from them. Nonetheless, they cannot forget Krishna. When Krishna left Vrindavan for Mathura, the gopis became most dejected and spent the rest of their lives simply crying in separation from Krishna. This means that in one sense, they were never actually separated from Krishna. There is no difference between thinking of Krishna and associating with him. Rather, vipralambha seva, thinking of Krishna in separation, as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu did, is far better than serving Krishna directly. Thus, of all the devotees who have developed unalloyed love for Krishna, the gopis are most exalted. And out of all these exalted gopis, Srimati Radharani is the highest. No one can excel the devotional service of Srimati Radharani. Indeed, even Krishna cannot understand the attitude of Srimati Radharani. Therefore, he took her position and appeared as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, just to understand her transcendental feelings. In this way, Srila Rupa Goswami gradually concludes that Srimati Radharani is the most exalted devotee of Krishna, and that her kunda lake is Sri Radha Kunda, is the most exalted place. This is verified in a quotation from Laghu Bhagavatamrita as quoted in Chaitanya Charitamrita. Yatha Radha Priya Vishnos Tasya Kundam Priyam Tatha Sarva Gopishu Saivaika Vishnu Ratyanta Vallabha. Just as Srimati Radharani is dear to the Supreme Lord Krishna, so her bathing place, Radha Kunda, is equally dear to Krishna. Among all the gopis, she alone stands supreme as the Lord's most beloved. Therefore, everyone interested in Krishna consciousness should ultimately take shelter of Radha Kunda and execute devotional service there throughout one's life. This is the conclusion of Rupa Goswami in the 10th verse of Upadeshamrita. Rupa Goswami here, he's making it very clear what the various levels of advancement in Krishna consciousness are. I remember yesterday in the second session we were talking about how making distinctions is a very necessary part of life in this world, and it's not a bad thing either, as long as that distinction is not mixed with envy and turning into judgmentalism. So that was kind of the conclusion last time. Mother Vishakha raised this point. It's a very important point because distinctions themselves are inevitable, whether you like them or not. They occur because that's how we make sense of the world. We make sense of the world by creating categories. And categories means distinctions. There's no way anyone can think without creating these distinctions. So distinctions will be there. Trying to destroy them is not the point. But those distinctions, when they're mixed with envy, they become judgmentalism. They become we become judgmental as a result. Okay. So Rupa Goswami here is describing a way of understanding devotees in different types of categories, with the aim of helping everyone, encouraging everyone to aspire to the highest levels of bhakti, not with the intent of putting anyone down. But the description that you find here is very wonderful. Let's start at the beginning, okay? Let's start at the very beginning. Krishna, he's all attractive. This is the very meaning of what Krishna is. He attracts everyone in this world. And we see that in fact is the case. If you look around to every culture, every society, one of the things that's most clearly visible, and this is in fact true throughout the range of human history, that every society has had some mode of worship of God, or some mode of aspiration for something higher than this world, than our own experience, than human society. And there used to be a time where anthropologists and others thought that, we found early society, like, I don't know, Stone Age people or Neanderthals, or who were just interested in making ends meet, so to speak, just interested in hunting and gathering and so forth. And religion was something that was introduced a little bit later as a result of cultural development. But in fact, even in the earliest examples of civilization we have, or people living in groups, obviously if you find one set of bones on its own, you can't tell what that person was doing. But if you find a group of people or a settlement or any kinds of ruins, from the earliest periods of human history, we find people doing something that shows an aspiration to a world beyond this, that shows an aspiration in the direction of God. Perhaps it's the worship of ancestors, or perhaps it's the search for an afterlife, or whatever it might be. But the point being that God is all attractive. Everyone is a devotee of God in some way or another. Everyone is searching for God, experiencing Him in some way. The alcoholic, the drunk, is experiencing God, is searching for God through means of alcohol. Right? He may not realize that fact, but Prabhupada says, even Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, rasoham apsukonteya, Krishna says, I am the taste of liquor. The word rasa in Sanskrit can mean water, but it can also mean liquor. Right? So, I am the taste of alcohol. And even that person is searching for Krishna. Because the Upanishads, they remind us that ananda, or bliss, happiness, is the ultimate goal of every being. That we know just by looking around us. Every living being from of every species is searching for happiness. If you see a colony of ants, for example, just a single ant crawling around, and the ant is making a beeline towards, that's a mixed metaphor, isn't it? An ant making a beeline. How about it? An ant making an ant line to, to a particular object. Maybe it's a grain of sugar or whatever it might be. And you put your thumb or your finger in front of that ant and block its path, and very confused and very disturbed. And he'll turn this way, turn that way, go around here and find a way to overcome the obstacle so it can still get to its desired object. And so everyone has that desired object. And the Upanishads say that desired object is ananda, or it's bliss. We're looking for happiness. And in fact, the Upanishads say that we don't actually love anything in this world, or even anyone. The only thing we're actually searching for is ananda, or happiness. Everything is somehow in the process, it's a mechanism, whether it's relationships with others, or whether it's some form of sense gratification we enjoy on our own, or whatever it might be. We're searching for that bliss, that ananda. And therefore, the Upanishads say that if we define what God is, or what ultimate reality is, then we must define Him as the source or the reservoir of that ananda. God has to be that by definition. Why? Because if He's not that ultimate source of ananda, then it means that He's not the ultimate goal or end for every living being. And if He's not the ultimate goal or end, then He might be a really amazing, wonderful person, but there's something else which is the ultimate goal, right? If it's not Him, then it's going to be something else. Then that person is actually God. You see what I mean? In other words, that God has to be the reservoir of all pleasure by definition, because if you don't make Him the reservoir of ananda by definition, then you're setting up a situation where someone else will in fact be God, because God has to be that object with the most value, the ultimate aim. Plato and Socrates, the ancient Greek philosophers, they didn't have a personal concept of God. But nevertheless, they understood this point, that whatever ultimate reality is, it has to be the ultimate good, they said. The ultimate good, that place for which everyone is seeking. Otherwise, what's the point? Means anyone could be God. I could be God, right? But the point is, I'm not God. Why? Because everyone's not seeking me. Maybe a couple people might seek me out, right? But the whole world is not seeking me out, because the amount of ananda I can give to others or even to myself is just this much. And this is why the definition of God is Rama. And Rama is defined as Ramate iti Ramaha. He who is constantly enjoying is Rama, Ramate. And Ramayati iti Ramaha. And he who is causing others to enjoy is Rama. So both ways. He can be good at keeping himself happy, and he can make everyone else happy. And for us, it's a struggle to do both is nearly impossible, but even to do one or the other. We focus on keeping ourselves happy, and sometimes others become unhappy with us. Right? You give me no time, and you haven't called in a week, and what's the matter, and so forth. Well, I've been really busy with my life. You know, things have been difficult. So you focus on yourself, and you keep yourself happy, and others get dissatisfied. You focus on others, and too much, and what happens? You stretch yourself so thin that you don't have any bandwidth left for your own sustenance. And pretty soon you're drained and you're exhausted, and you have to go on a retreat somewhere and hide yourself from the world, right? So we're flipping, we're flopping back and forth. We try Ramati for some time, we try Ramayati for some time. And we can't manage both together, and definitely not beyond a small social sphere. And therefore we're not Rama. We're not Rama. We're just Ananda Kana. We're little drops of ananda, but not ananda ghana, which is the complete reservoir of ananda. The difference. Ananda kana, ananda ghana. Kana is just little drop, ghana is the, like ghanashyam, Krishna put it, just the full reservoir, the density. The word ghana means density. Krishna is dense with ananda, with bliss. So, this is what everyone's looking for, is ananda. This is Krishna's all attractive. So, because everyone is seeking ananda, and Krishna by definition is ananda, then it means that everyone is seeking Krishna. Right? And that means what? If someone is seeking Krishna, that person is a devotee. That person is a bhakta. In this way, by definition, every living entity is a devotee of Krishna. Every living entity is a Vaishnava. And this point we hear in this famous verse, Jivera Swarupoi Krishneda Nitya Das. That the eternal constitutional position of every living entity is Krishna Das. Whether they realize it or not, but everyone's a devotee. So this is kind of the fundamental platform. We see everyone is a servant of Krishna. Everyone is a bhakta, because everyone is seeking ananda. But, of course, there are differences into the level of success that a person has achieved, has gained in trying to achieve that ananda. Not everyone is quite there. Someone seeking it in alcohol, for example, is in for a disappointment. It may work for a little while, but it's going to turn stale very soon and lead to plenty of suffering in addition to that. So the purposes of these distinctions here is just to see where everyone's at in their progress to ananda ghana, to that reservoir of complete ananda, to that ultimate source of all bliss, where everyone's at. And if we see it like this, then there's no reason to be judgmental about it. Because just as if, just like a group of people came from New Jersey here to D.C. Now, I'm sure many of you started at different points. Maybe you all came together. But suppose there's six cars heading from New Jersey to D.C. D.C. is the destination. Now, if someone's just getting started and someone's halfway there and someone's almost there, is the person who's almost there going to look back and kind of snicker and spit at the people who are behind him in the highway? No. Well, why would you do that, right? They started a little later, but they're on the same road, and it's only a matter of time if you keep driving that you're going to get there, right? So it's not that travelers who are closer to the destination then look down upon travelers who are behind them. No, there's no reason. I mean, you'd be foolish to do something like that. Because the point is, it's only a matter of time before everyone gets there. And the example is given of an unripe mango. It's only a matter of time before the mango ripens. You just put it anywhere, it's going to ripen over time. So you just, if we continue with the process of bhakti or devotional service, we will get there at the end, no doubt. And this is why Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita very clearly, mama manu vartante manushyaha partha sarvasha. He says, everyone is on my path, O Arjuna. Everyone is in my path. He doesn't say every path leads to the same goal. No. He says, in fact, that there is only one path. Not every path. Because that suggests that there's multiple paths, and Krishna doesn't accept that. He says, no, there's only one path in this world. What's that path? The path toward ananda. That's what the path everyone's on. Everyone's a seeker of happiness. Therefore, everyone's my seeker, seeking me. Therefore, everyone's on my path, O Arjuna. Just ye yatha mam prapadyante. It's just a difference in terms of how far along they are on that path. That's all. So, some people seek that happiness in this, in the objects of the senses. Hopefully, if they do that enough, the idea here is that they're going to experience some level of disappointment. Just like Gopal was saying yesterday, this world is kind of set up perfectly to create that sense of disappointment. That's its purpose, so that we might seek something beyond. And the whole problem of philosophy, the whole problem of religion, begins with the human condition. The reason people seek God and they seek philosophy, they seek higher things, is because of our condition. Not because they're actually interested in God, but because of our condition. We look at our situation and we go, there's got to be something better than this. There's got to be something more. Okay, let's try to find it. So some people become disappointed, embarrassed, as Prabhupada says, embarrassed with their condition here in the material world, and they say, let's look for something more. So they think, okay, if I work hard and I offer my work for others, then that'll be satisfying. Offer my reserve. Then, okay, it's not just about me, it's about others. And you feel a sense of satisfaction when you live your life for others. Some people go a little bit beyond that, and they say, how about I offer my work to God? And this will not only please others, because everyone is participating in the Lord, everyone is part of the Lord, but it's going to actually give me some ultimate satisfaction, because I'll develop a relationship with God. These people are called karmis. And Krishna says, this is really nice, karma yoga. It says the famous verse, karma niva vikaraste ma phaleshu vikarashu ma karma. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, but you're not entitled to the fruits of action. And for a lot of people, this is the final statement of Bhagavad Gita. If you talk to someone from India and you say, what is the Gita about? You'll say, karmanyeva adhikaraste mahadishvarasata. You have a right to perform your prescribed duty, you're not entitled to the fruits of action. And this is the sum and substance of the Gita. And that's okay. That's the level that they're operating at, and it's a very good point. Krishna encourages us to do that. But if they're ready for it, we can remind them, of course, that that verse only appears in second chapter of Bhagavad Gita. Right? There's a lot more that happens beyond that. That verse doesn't even yet mention that one should offer the results of one's work to God. It's just do it as a matter of duty. So one does karma yoga, and Krishna says this is good, but better than someone who pursues karma yoga is someone who knows why they're acting. So to act is good, but to know why you're acting along with the action is even better. That person then comes to the point of jnana, or knowledge. And they try to seek out God through the power of their intelligence. The pleasure one achieves from working for others is very great. But the pleasures of the mind are much greater still. They're amazing. The ananda you receive from contemplating higher reality, philosophy, is so much better than the ananda that one gets from working hard. And both are some source of ananda. But the pleasures of the mind are inestimable. My Guru Maharaj calls it eating the bananas of the mind. Right? Eating the bananas of the mind. It's immense pleasure. And if you're a jnani, you know, often we kind of look down upon jnanis and we say, oh, the jnanis, the dry mental speculators. And yes, from the perspective of the devotee, they are dry. But from the perspective of everyone else in the mature world, jnana is so full of juice. Right? It's amazing, that happiness, that bliss of knowledge. If you can just keep turning and turning. And the world of the mind is unlimited. It's far, if we think this world is limitless, the forms of sense gratification available to us in this world, just look at the world of the mind. There's no extent, there's no limit to how much pleasure you can achieve there. This is why jnanis, they become completely detached from the world. They have... They lose their desire for making money, even for social relationships, for keeping their body healthy, fit and strong. Very rarely will you find a jnani going to a gym and working out. They're usually frail and thin, or too fat because they've been sitting in a chair all day. Either way, they don't care about the needs of the body. They'll be burrowed in a book in a library, and they might have some kind of a job in which they're just, you know, a professor teaching or doing research or whatever, and they've spent they have some kind of a basic salary, and it keeps the ends, and they don't care. I mean, they're not into making more, into getting a raise, into moving up. And really, you look at them sometimes and go, wow, these are really self-satisfied people. They're detached from the material world. And yes, that's true, but they're only detached from one part of the material world. That's the gross part. Bhumi rapo nalo vayu, earth, water, fire, ether. The physical aspects of the material world, they have very little to do with. But there's a whole other side to this material world, which we cannot see. Right? And half the time, we're not aware of it even. And that's kam mano buddhi, the intelligence, the mind, and the ego. Oh, that world is just amazing. It's full of variety in so many different activities and so forth. And therefore you find that often these people have very greatly inflated egos along with their very, very sharp intelligence, because that's the part of the material world in which they're focusing. Is they're proud of their subtle body. They know I'm not this material body, but they think I'm this subtle body. I'm the mind. I'm the intelligence. That's me. Who is that person? Well, he's that really smart guy. Yeah, that's him. That's me. I'm the smart guy. So I'm identifying with my intelligence. With my body, I don't care. I could wear anything, it doesn't matter. Right? From the jnani's perspective, no problem. So the point is, ananda is much greater. At each level, you get a certain level of happiness. And being good at your level is a very admirable thing. Right? A very good karma yogi is not someone to spit at. That person has accomplished a lot. even on the path to spiritual life. A good jnana yogi is very good. I mean, that person is experiencing greater happiness than most of us in this world can hope to achieve. Those who are really, you know, on that level of jnana. Like the four Kumaras before they saw Lord Vishnu. But then the bliss of jnana, it really is minuscule, that ananda. It's just a tiny drop in comparison to the bliss of bhakti or of devotion. That as soon as you add pure relationship to the mix, then the pleasures of the mind seem completely futile. They seem completely useless. It's like eating a banana after you've had a gulab jamun. The bananas are wonderful. They taste very well and they're very sweet. But you eat it after gulab jamun and you'll feel like you're eating some kind of tasteless mush. It won't taste like anything. Because once you've tasted the sweetness of a gulab jamun, all the other things become useless, become uninteresting. And so, from the perspective of the bhakta then, you look down and everything else is tasteless. So this idea of different forms of jnana, you see different forms of happiness, rather. You see throughout this world, if you look carefully, people have different levels of happiness. And for people whose happiness is below ours, we look at them and we think, oh, it's not so great. And we look above and we aspire for that form of happiness. So an animal's happiness, we look at and say, not too good. Look at how much fear they're in. Just recently, Gopal was telling me that the seals, they only sleep, 20 minutes? Or no, maybe Amitabh was telling me. They sleep like 20 minutes to half an hour in 24 hours. And that too, they get chunks of 5 minutes each. And the reason for that is that they're constantly in terror of being attacked and eaten. So they can't afford to sleep for more than 5 minutes. Now, from our perspective, that's a condition of great suffering, to have that level of insomnia where you can't sleep and you can't stay asleep for more than 5 minutes. It's terrible. But from the seal's perspective, he's doing just fine. Like, his happiness is okay. He appreciates those 30 minutes he gets. And in the same way, our level of happiness, we think, oh, life is pretty good, we're secure, there's not too much to worry about, not too much anxiety. Okay, some crime and some, you know, this and that. But otherwise, life is pretty nice. But from the perspective of the demigods, they look down on us, and they look at us like we look at the seals. We think, boy, how do these people put up with their life? Did you see how they lock the doors every night? And they've got alarm systems, and they've got like 4 different levels of insurance they operate through? How could you live like that, you know? Constantly in fear of something going wrong. They don't need any insurance there because their bodies are perfectly healthy. They don't need to lock doors except for when the demons attack. It's a very, you know, and for them, the only level of suffering or anxiety comes from the demons making a concerted effort to take over the heavenly planets. It would be like, you know, if one day Russia attacked the United States. That is that a fear for us? No. I mean, it's there, maybe, you know, at some periods of history, it may have been a greater fear, like during the Cold War and so forth, where it was actually on people's minds. For us now, it's either not on our mind or it's so deeply embedded that it doesn't make a difference. That's kind of the way the demigods live their life. Right? Every once in a while, there'll be a war going on between the demons, and it's on the forefront of everyone's, it's a societal problem, and then for most of the time, they're just enjoying. So from their perspective, our bliss is nothing. And then from the perspective of the spiritual world, the life of the demigod is quite miserable. The suffering that they have to go, the anxiety that Indra is constantly facing in terms of maintaining his position as king of heaven, and so forth. So, karmis, jnanis, devotees. Then, so many people are devotees. So many people achieve God, strive for God in various ways. The whole world approaches God for one purpose. What's that main purpose that everyone comes to God for? Specifically. Yeah, for help, right? Because they're in distress and they want relief, or because they need something. चतुर्विधा भजन्ते मां जना सुकृतिनोर्जन आर्थो जिज्ञासुर अर्थाति ज्ञानि च भरतर्षभ. These people come to God because they're in some kind of a difficulty or some kind of problem, and they need God to help them. So why does God exist? For them. For who they are. And therefore, if you look at every description or designation of God that you find around the world, it's always in relation to us. He's the Creator. He's the Father. He's the Lord. He's the Judge. The preserver, the maintainer, the destroyer, whatever it might be. Every description of God, practically speaking, is always in relation to us, who we are, what God can do. And in a certain stage of a person's development, that's actually healthy. Like a little child, a small child loves the parents, but that love is for a long time pretty one-directional. The parents are in the mode of giving, 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 and the child's main form of love is asking. Daddy, can I have this? Mommy, I'm hungry. I want to go here. I want to do that. And the parents feel that the child loves them, right? But how is the child expressing that love? Just by asking. Give me this, give me this, give me this. So Krishna doesn't actually mind when we ask him. It just shows him that this person is still a two-year-old. That's all. That two-year-olds, three-year-olds, four, this is the mode of love in which we express. So at a certain stage when a person is first approaching God, that's actually healthy. If a person is in a great deal of suffering, it's healthy for them to come to the temple and beg God for relief. Because unless they're going to get relief from their suffering, how will you sit down with them and explain to them how Queen Kunti asked for more suffering in her life? You tell that to a person who's not there, and they'll never come back. They'll never approach God anymore. They'll just freak out and they'll go, this is crazy. You know, I'll go to the government for relief, or I'll go somewhere else. But if this is what God asked me, to double my suffering when I'm already suffering. So no, it's not good. It's very difficult for a child at a certain stage of development to think in relation to what is the other person feeling on the other side of this relationship. And you hope that at a certain stage a child starts thinking that. Oh, what are my parents' needs? What do they want? You know, perhaps it's my duty, now that I'm living away from home, to give them a call once a week. Instead of them always calling me and asking, do you need money? Can I send you anything? So that's what Krishna is hoping. That, okay, it's okay. People come and ask him. Krishna actually feels very flattered. He feels like a parent. He wants to care for us. This is why he's made us. If he didn't want to, he could get rid of us very easily. But no, he likes doing that. He likes taking care of us. But greater than those devotees are those who are a little mature. And they ask, not just what can I get from God, but what can I do for God? So they do there what they want in this world, but in addition to that, they do something for God. They pursue their lives, and they make sure that they reciprocate with God in some way or another. So, I've just gotten a new job. Okay, I should offer the first paycheck to Krishna. Make sure that Krishna feels reciprocated for what he gave me. My child is born, I should take the child first and place him at the feet of the deities of the temple. Krishna gave me a gift, I should reciprocate. So, what can I give as part of the relationship? That's much nicer. Much more mature. Krishna appreciates that a lot more. But then, there's something even better than that. Even higher. Instead of saying, I'm doing what I want to, and let me make sure Krishna doesn't feel left out, how about I make Krishna the center of everything I do? How about I make Krishna the center of my life? There's no question of leaving Krishna out there. It's no question of pursuing and making sure Krishna is part of my social circle. I don't want to leave my parents out. I don't want to leave Krishna out. I don't want to leave my friends out. Like, Krishna's part of my social circle. No, how about I make Krishna the center of that social circle, where it's all about Krishna? Then we start talking about real love. Then we start talking about real love. We can find glimpses of this in this world. It's just like when two persons fall in love for each other madly. Then, for the first few months or whatever, at the beginning of the relationship, All that matters is the other person. Everything in life is centered around them. You may be doing other activities, but it's all either for that person, or all you're doing is thinking about the person as you pursue your activities, your other things. The mind is 100% focused, and therefore constantly distracted, because it's focused on the object of one's love. In this world, that doesn't last very long. It stays for a few months, and then things settle down, and the relationship cools off a bit, and okay, I've got some needs in the relationship too, and you've got some needs in the relationship, so we have to make sure we satisfy both, and so forth. So we can't keep that maintained for a while. But the prema bhakta is someone who's in that mode towards Krishna constantly, nonstop, where what are Krishna's needs? I just like to look at Mother Yashoda. Such a wonderful example. In class, in my Gods and Goddesses of India course at William & Mary, just last week, we were talking about different types of relationships one can have with God, five different rasas. And I laid out the, kind of a neutral rasa and the servitude and friendship and parental love and conjugal love. And I kind of laid them down, and there were a few questions from the students, and at one point I realized that I hadn't clarified something. When I listed parental love, then the students automatically assumed that who was the parent? God was the parent. And you were the child. That was the automatic assumption that, parental love means you see God as your father, and you're the child. Is that, no, that actually comes in the master-servant relationship. Right? Or it's another side of vatsalya, it can be. But here what I primarily meant is that you're the parent. God, oh, what? You're the parent? Can that be the case? How can, right? It's a complete shift in thought. It's a complete shift in mind. It takes a lot of work to think in that way. Why would you relate to God in that way? It's very difficult to wrap your head around, actually. But no, I'm constantly concerned about what God wants, what His needs are. And Krishna then reciprocates by making His primary concern, what are the devotee's needs? What does the devotee want? So it's not that He's simply looking for, well, how many people can be keep me at the center. No, the center of Krishna's circle is not Him. The center of His circle is the devotees. So in this way, it makes for a very beautiful relationship. Because the devotee is constantly thinking, what are Krishna's needs? And Krishna is constantly thinking, what are the devotees' needs? Now, even amongst devotees, whose primary and sole concern is to love Krishna, there are different degrees of surrender, of selflessness, of complete self-surrender, atmanevyadana or sharanagati. And no one epitomizes that sense of selflessness more than the gopis. And of the gopis, Srimati Radharani. There's no example of that kind of selflessness that's greater than their example. Take a look, for example, at the 8th verse of the Shikshastaka, in which Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is speaking in the mood of Srimati Radharani. He says, Ashishyava padaratam pinashtumam adarshanan marmahatam karotuva yatha tathava vidadhatulam pato matprananathastu saivanapara matprananathastu saivana. He says, Ashishyava, you can embrace me. Ashishyava padaratam pinashtumam. Or you can crush me by your embrace. Or you can crush me by not being present before me. So you can embrace me or you can reject me. However way you like. Present before me or not present in front of my eyes. Yatha tatha va vidadhatu lampoto. Whatever you want to do, Krishna, oh, the word is lampata here, which is a bad word in Sanskrit. You don't call someone a lampat. It means a loose person, a debauchee. Right? It's not a very flattering term. Right? Whatever you want to do, oh, you lampat. We know what you're like. Whatever you want to do, it's okay. We don't matter. It doesn't matter. Why? Mat prananathastu sa eva napara. You are our Lord, the Lord of our life, and no one else. We have no choice. Okay? There's a beautiful verse that Rupa Goswami writes in regard to Srimati Radharani. I believe it's Purnamasi, the grandmother of the gopis, the residents of Vrindavan, the caretaker. She's speaking about Radharani. That person whom all the yogis try to fix their mind upon, even for a moment, this foolish girl is trying to forget just for a moment. Right? Radharani's whole struggle is somehow, if I can get Krishna out of my mind just for a moment, I could get some relief. Right? Because she's so attached, so attracted to Krishna. And she says, this foolish girl, she is trying to forget just for a moment that person whom everyone is striving to see just for a moment. Right? The whole world is waiting for darshan of Krishna just for a moment. And this person is trying to forget Krishna just for a moment. That's the level of attachment we're talking about. That's the level of attraction. That love becomes so pure, so it becomes so intensified, that not only is Krishna the center of your life, but even if Krishna does everything possible to avoid you, to reject you in some way, then even then, he's the center of your life. One of the most moving examples of this you find is in Srimad Bhagavatam, in the account of Uddhav returning to Vrindavan and the message that Krishna sends with him to the gopis. And when Uddhav arrives there, he sees the condition. Prabhupada was discussing it in this purport we just read. He sees the condition of the residents of Vrindavan. That, as Prabhupada said here, they practically spent their whole life crying. This was what the gopis did, what everyone did in Vrindavan. Is because how many years of his life did Krishna stay there? 11, 12 years? Yeah, of his life? And how many years was he on the planet?
125
at the time of the Bhagavad Gita. Imagine, I mean, we read so much about Krishna Lila and Vrindavan, but in terms of the proportion of time that the residents of Vrindavan actually had Krishna's association, this much only. And the rest of the time, they spent crying. When Uddhav arrived there in Vrindavan, he saw new rivers formed besides the Yamuna, consisting simply of the tears of Mother Yashoda and Nanda Maharaj. They had practically not eaten anything their whole lifetime, since Krishna had left. And of course, no one felt that separation like the gopis. And when Uddhav meets the gopis, he's amazed, he's shocked at the depth of their love. And of course, as is his duty as a messenger, he delivers Krishna's message. Now, reading it, I always think, look at the message that Krishna sent the gopis. After someone who loves them so much, and finally after, 50, 60 years, after promising to return, you finally then at least send a message. Okay, you send a letter. And then in that letter, do you know what Krishna said? He didn't say, I'm really missing you, I love you so much, and when can I see you again? He said something like, you have to understand that I'm actually present everywhere. And you're also part of me, ultimately. And therefore, we're never separated. You should learn how to detach yourself and to feel my presence every place. And the gopis are listening to this, just going, what's he thinking? How do we even respond to this? And their only responses to that message, oh, how's Krishna doing? After they hear that whole message, they say, okay, that's all nice, that's all fine. But does Krishna ever remember any of us here? Krishna didn't answer that question in the letter. He didn't say, I remember you, I miss you a lot. They have to ask Uddhava, does Krishna ever miss you, ever miss any of us here? And they're dying to know whether Krishna misses them or not, but they're too embarrassed to ask. So they start off by saying, does he ever miss all the friends and family he has here? Does he ever miss his parents, Nanda Maharaj and Mother Yashoda? And finally they say, does he ever remember us at all? And Uddhava is just overwhelmed by this. He's just overtaken. He doesn't know what to say. He really understands that the whole point of his being sent there was not to deliver the message at all. That it wasn't the gopis who needed the message, it was he who needed to learn as a result of that. But you know the most amazing thing? That it's after the gopis hear all this and they hear Uddhava's response and everything, they tell Uddhava, please make sure you don't tell Krishna what our condition is like, what situation we're in. Please make sure you don't tell Krishna what we're going through. Why? Why don't they want Krishna to know? Because he's going to feel bad about what he did. He's going to blame himself. And that will cause him suffering. Now, just think of that. Just imagine. If someone is the center of our life, if we love them wholeheartedly, if we do everything for them, if we can't stop crying in their absence, what's the least we want in reciprocation? What's the least thing we would desire? Is for them to at least know how much we love them and what we're going through for them, right? Even if we're happy to go through that suffering for someone else, at least we want them to know that, you know, I'm here and I'm missing you. And this is what I'm going through for you. But the gopis' love was so selfless in nature that not only did they love Krishna unconditionally after he had been absent for half a century at least, but when the only opportunity arose to actually tell Krishna what they were going through, they chose to skip that. They asked Uddhava not to do it, just because they couldn't bear the thought of Krishna feeling bad. Just because they couldn't bear the thought of Krishna feeling bad. That's what you call selfless love. It's a form of love that's actually unimaginable and impossible in this world. If we try to have this kind of relationship in the world, we're setting ourselves up for to be used, right? To be actually, it can be a very dangerous thing. When that love is expressed toward, without Krishna as the center of that love, it can actually be a very dangerous thing. Because no one has the ability to hold, to handle, to receive that love, except for Krishna. No one has the ability to properly appreciate that love, except for Krishna. So if we express that love to someone who cannot appreciate it, then it can be a very dangerous thing. This is why love has to be expressed appropriately to the recipient, in their capability, in their ability to receive it. Just like the example Prabhupada gives a lot is if you feed milk to a serpent, you may be expressing love to that serpent, but if the serpent is not the proper recipient, doesn't know how to receive or appreciate that love, then it can be a dangerous situation. You feed the serpent milk, and the serpent becomes stronger and proximate to you, and you get bitten, you get killed. If you show love to a dog in a way that's not appropriate, you love a dog in the way one would a human being, then that too can create a dangerous or difficult situation. If you offer love to a child in a way that the child is not ready for, or is not appropriate to that level, when we offer love, there has to be a proper recipient of that love. Otherwise, we set ourselves up for great disappointment, great suffering and upset. And the only person who can actually handle this type of love, which we have inside of us, we're capable of giving, but the only person who can handle it is Krishna, who can actually deal with it. That's Krishna. Just like when the Ganga came down from the heavenly planets to earth, there's not anyone could handle the force of her arrival. It was Lord Shiva who had to open up the locks of his hair and receive the powerful force of the Ganga. So when this type of torrential love emerges from the heart of a devotee, then it's only Krishna who can handle it, who can receive it properly and do something wonderful with it and reciprocate that love. Now, one could say, well, what kind of love is this? I thought we started talking about Krishna as a reservoir of bliss or ananda. And we do this quest for ananda and we achieve higher and higher goals and we achieve ananda at the end. And in the end, we're left with what? Unending suffering. Streams of tears. Right? Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Yugayatam nimeshena chakshusha pravrishayatam shunyayatam jagat sarva govinda vinahina. Shunyay, the whole world is empty, the rains are coming out like the monsoon rains, is this what the quest is all about? It's a big disappointment, a big letdown at the end. It's a big con. One could imagine it's very, the light at the end of the tunnel is an oncoming train. This is the pessimist's view of the world. Oh, there's light at the end of the tunnel. Right? It must be an oncoming train. But this is what it looks like, right? We strive for this ananda, this bliss, and we make progress on Krishna's path, and poof, we're run over at the end. We're fooled. No, it's not like that. And this is why that sentence we read. Anyway, I can't. Yeah. When Krishna left Vrindavan for Mathura, the gopis became most dejected and spent the rest of their lives simply crying in separation from Krishna. This means that in one sense they were never actually separated from Krishna. That's a full-on contradiction from a material point of view. That they spent their lives crying in separation from Krishna. Therefore, they were not actually separated from Krishna. And in order to understand that perspective, the only way we can understand it, the only point at which we can understand it, is when we know what it means to actually remember Krishna. And this is why the nectar instruction, if you read the verses leading up to this, one of the things Rupa Goswami does very clearly is he describes the different stages of remembrance of Krishna. What it means to actually create intense remembrance. Because unless we understand what remembrance of Krishna means, we won't be able to appreciate how an apparent separation from Krishna can actually be Krishna's presence and can actually be the highest form of happiness, the greatest form of bliss. It's impossible to understand. Because that remembrance is not anything ordinary. It's something all the Vaishnava acharyas actually talk about, is the depths of meditation, of remembrance. This is the whole point of the yogic process, is to come to the point of samadhi. We think of remembrance, shavanam, kirtanam, vishnu, smarana, hearing, chanting, remembering, as something you might do, like if I ask you to remember your homes, right? Or remember your family back in India, or remember your last vacation. Well, you can do that. Pretty easy. But this is not what we're talking about in terms of remembrance. Ramanujacharya, he describes this remembrance as taila-dharava, he says, like a stream of oil. When you pour, say you've got a bottle of oil, olive oil, and you pour it into something, then when a stream of oil flows, then the stream is completely smooth and it's completely unbroken. Unlike when you pour water. If you pour water, then it's all broken and changing, and it, more can gush out and less, and it splatters everywhere. It's a broken... No, taila dharava. He says that meditation is like the stream of oil flowing from a bottle to a container. And this is described in Srimad Bhagavatam as ahetuki apratishtha. Unbroken and unmotivated. An intensity of meditation that makes Krishna present there. Krishna is actually present in that location. He's drawn by the meditation of that devotee to that place. So intense is that meditation that no matter how hard we try, we cannot get Krishna out of our heads. That's when we know that we actually are remembering Krishna. That when we remember Krishna, we can't get Krishna out of our heads anymore. That's a struggle. That's when separation from Krishna becomes the highest happiness. It becomes the greatest presence of Krishna. That's when separation from Krishna is actually a wonderful thing. Until that point, a separation from Krishna is a terrible thing. It's actually not very good. In other words, our situation right now is opposite. No matter how hard we try, we can't seem to keep Krishna in our minds. And so if we say, oh, I want to feel the separation that the gopis had for Krishna, bad idea. We've been experiencing that separation now for millions of lifetimes. Separation from Krishna. And how do we feel about it? Oh, just fine. No problem. It's not too bad. Krishna can be. No, we become separated from Krishna and it's not a problem. Just like they have two sayings. They say distance makes the heart grow fonder, right? Something like that. And they also say out of sight, out of mind. There's actually a lot of common sayings that contradict each other. And you use whichever ones are appropriate at the moment. Like they say, haste makes waste. You've heard that? Haste makes waste. But a stitch in time saves nine. So they always come in pairs. So the point is actually they're all true, depending on the circumstance, depending on the context. Out of sight, out of mind. But distance makes the heart grow fonder. In our case with Krishna, it's out of sight, out of mind. We're not. We try to try out separation from Krishna, and it's there's no problem. Krishna, it's fine. I can live my life without Krishna. And the gopis, they try separation from Krishna, and they meditate on Krishna even more, all the more. Krishna leaves and their meditation becomes more intense on Krishna. When Krishna left the Rasa dance and the gopis were reenacting his pastimes, they were relishing those pastimes more in their reenactment of those pastimes than they were when those pastimes actually occurred. Because their meditation became doubled in intensity as a result of Krishna's separation. So that's the point. This is why Prabhupada says that in the beginning, you know, we strive for connection with Krishna. We strive for union. That's a good thing. But as in terms of the ultimate goal in the line of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the ultimate goal is service and separation. There's nothing more wonderful than that. Thank you. Nothing more intense than that. And no one can experience that service and separation with such intensity as Srimati Radharani. No one can experience it like her. That Mahabhava is not accessible to any living being. In fact, her love for Krishna is so intense that it surprises Krishna himself. Krishna himself can't make sense of it. He can't understand it. And this is why precisely he comes as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. There's a very nice verse describing who Srimati Radharani is and who Krishna is. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is in relation to Srimati Radharani. Found very early on in Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's one of the defining verses, the key verses of the entire Chaitanya Charitamrita. It goes like this. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Hladini Shakti Rasmat. Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikritir Hladini Shakti Rasmat. Ekatmanav Abhibhuvipura Deha Bhedam Gatoto. Ekatmanav Abhibhuvipura Deha Vedam Gatoto. Chaitanyakhyam Prakatamaduna Tadvayam Chaikyamaptam. Chaitanyakhyam Prakatamaduna Tadvayam Chaikyamaptam. Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupam. Radha Bhava Dyuti Suvalitam Nomi Krishna Swarupam. This is actually the same meter, the same melody as the last verse of Nectar of Instruction. The Mandakanta, that so slow ambling meter that I mentioned last time, is that one. It says, Radha Krishna Pranaya Vikriti. Radha, here, she's defined, described as Krishna Pranaya Vikriti. The transformation of Krishna's love. Krishna Pranaya Vikriti. Of the transformation, the presence, the manifestation of love for Krishna. Hladini Shakti, and therefore she's Krishna's pleasure-giving potency. Hladini. The word hlada means the same as ananda. So hladini anandini. She who possesses or gives happiness or ananda. In other words, now just think about this. We started off defining God as the reservoir of all ananda, of all bliss. And now Krishnadas Kaviraj Goswami is saying that if that is what makes God, God, right? That's the essence of God. Then that very essence, that ananda, which is actually the primary characteristic of God, his essential characteristic, that's Srimati Radharani. So that means what? You take away Radha from Krishna, what's left? Nothing. Nothing. Means if God is, by definition, ananda, Rama, the reservoir of ananda, and that very ananda is Srimati Radharani, Hladini Shakti. Then it means there's no Radha without Krishna, there's no Krishna without Radha. The two are in fact the same person. Therefore, in the next line he says, Ekatmanav. They're one soul, they're one person. Because it's even logically not possible to conceive of the two ever being separate. Because you've destroyed the very definition of God. God cannot exist without that being. Radharani is the definition of Krishna, in other words. She is who, it is she who defines Krishna, makes Krishna who he is. Even as she is the energy of Krishna, you see? So this is actually a very, very important, very powerful point. These days in the academic world, in the study of religion, religious traditions around the world are seeking different ways for finding a place for the feminine within religion, for the divine feminine. And with my students, this is a very important topic of discussion. That how does a religious tradition create a space for valuing the female side of creation? God is always described as Father. He's always described as creator. He's always described as judge. He's always described in this way and that way. But what about God as mother? What about God as the source of everything, as in she who gives birth to everything? What about God as a person with feminine characteristics? And the beauty of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy is that it's there. She's there. God is a she with a capital S, just as he is a he with a capital S, an H. Krishna is both supreme male and supreme female. And as a supreme female, he's Srimati Radharani. God is supreme father and he is supreme mother. God is the seed-giving father. He's also the birth-giving womb of all living beings. And that's Srimati Radharani. So a very a powerful concept. It's actually, if we, in terms of our work as preachers, as teachers, as in doing outreach to others, in terms of explaining our philosophy, in terms of understanding it ourselves, it's a very important point to keep in mind. That this is a great asset. It's a wonderful thing, because this is not true of every school of Hinduism. It's not even true of every school of Vaishnavism. But this is specifically Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's emphatic point. Ekatmana. They're one being. They're one soul. The Lord is the best of both supreme male qualities and female qualities. And this distinction between male and female is an eternal one. It's a supreme one. But ekatmana api bhuvipura deha bhedam gatautam. Even though they're one soul, from time immemorial, deha bhedam, they become two. Deha bhedam gatautam. That one soul has become two. Why? For what purpose? Simply to relish this ananda. Simply to relish this pleasure. They're always two. They're one soul, but they're two. Why? Because only when they're two can they relish happiness, can they relish bliss. Alone, no one can relish happiness. No one can taste that bliss. Krishna makes Radha happy, Radha makes Krishna happy. But jaitanyakyam prakadamaduna tadvayam jaityamapta. But that duality, okay? So in the beginning, only one, they're one soul. But they have been a duality from the start. They've been two. That duality has now become one again and is called Chaitanya. Chaitanyakyam, by the name of Chaitanya. Chaitanyakyam prakatam adhuna is now appeared. Tadvayam jaikyamapta. That duality has now appeared as one. How? Radha bhava dyuti suvalitam nomi Krishna swarupam. He is Krishna himself, none different, Krishna swarupa. Right? But Radha bhava dyuti suvalitam. He's decorated with two things. Radha bhava, the mood of Srimati Radharani, and Radha dyuti, her complexion, her color. So this is the wonderful dialectic of the Godhead. This back and forth. The Lord is one, but he's two. He's two, but he's one. He's one ultimately. There's no doubt. God is one. We understand. We're monotheists. Yes. Ekatmana. Oh, but he becomes two. For the pleasure of happiness. And some will say, no, you can't do that. God cannot become two. Say, no, he can become two. He becomes two. In fact, he becomes many. But first, specifically, most importantly, two. And just in case you think that, oh, there's two gods. No, he's one. Only one. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And that Chaitanya Mahaprabhu spends all his time worshipping the two. Radha and Krishna. So back and forth, one and two, two and one, one and two. This is why it's called achintya bheda bheda. Achintya. Because it's really difference and non-difference. One, two, one, two, one, two. And all that makes us our head spin. Very confusing. Therefore it's called achintya, inconceivable. Oh my God, how can this be the case? God is one, is he two? Is he two, is he one? It's much easier, it's much clearer. Like some religions of the world, they say, God is one, period. No incarnations, no multiple forms, no consorts, nothing. God is one, period.
It's easy to understand.
Yeah, it's much easier to grasp. It's actually chintya, it's conceivable. God is one. I've got one boss. Right? God is one. Simple. And then multiplicity is easy to conceive as well. Polytheism. God is many, or there are many gods, many realities. So the ancient Greeks, they believe this. The Karmakandiyas in the Vedas, they believe this. Well, there's many gods. Indra takes care of the rains, and Vayu takes care of the wind, and Agni takes care of the fire. All different departments and different people responsible. You can wrap your head around that. It's not difficult. But our philosophy? Completely illogical. Two, one, two, one, two, one. Monotheist? Yes. You believe in more than one God? Yes. What about two? How come you have six gods on your altar? Well, you're actually all one. Oh, okay. Then why do you need six there? Really, why do we need six? We should just have one deity on the altar. It's all Krishna. Right? Rama is Krishna. Radha is Krishna. Krishna is Krishna. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is Krishna. Nithai is Krishna. Lakshman is Krishna. Maybe the only one who's not Krishna is Hanuman. He's also a marginal energy of Krishna. Ultimately, it's all Krishna. So we could just have Krishna on the altar. Simple as that. And again, there are Vaishnava sampradayas who worship just Krishna. And there's nothing wrong with that. That's very nice. But the specific contribution of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is to say, yes, there's only Krishna. Krishna is one, but we need nine deities on the altar. Right? Why? Because Krishna is relating to every devotee in multiple ways, is experiencing those relationships in multiple ways. And depending on the bhava or the mood of the devotee, Krishna will reciprocate accordingly. That's the deeper import of this verse that we started off with from the Gita. We can explain it in terms of karmis and jnanis and so forth. But that verse is equally applicable in the spiritual world. Krishna is reciprocating according to each devotee's surrender. Depending on the mood they want to approach Krishna with. He takes a form just for that reason. And just recently I had a student came to my office and she was doing a reading on Krishna and these different relationships and so forth. And she had very genuine questions. She was asking, well, what's the point of this all? Like, you know, Krishna's, he's, you know, we've read stories of Krishna stealing butter and running from his mother. And she's like, well, why does God act this way? And I said, no, he's not acting. He's actually feeling afraid of his mother. Okay, and then he's got lovers and thousands of gopis, and then he's got his friends and his whole, and different relationships, and we're studying different aspects. But what's the point of all of this? And I said, well, it's just to experience relationships, just for this purpose of happiness. And she said, that's it? That's all? I mean, I said, yeah, because what is God going to accomplish? Right? It's for us, it can be very difficult to conceive because every action in this world is goal-oriented. We have something to achieve, something to gain from every work that we do. So when someone says that, you know, if you look at the average person's life, it's as complicated as Krishna's life is in terms of different kinds of relationships and people and this and that. We never ask why, what's the point? No, you have to You have to work and keep a relationship with your boss for money, and you need a relationship with your kids, and you need a relationship with your husband or your wife, and so forth. Because we've got things to accomplish in this world, things to achieve. But for someone who has nothing to accomplish, where there's no goal-oriented action, action that's not goal-oriented, we actually have no concept of that in this world. We only start to get a concept of it when we start chanting the holy names with some feeling. Then we understand the possibility, even the theoretical possibility, of action that is not goal-oriented, that has no goal in mind. What are you going to get out of this? Nothing. What's the point? Why are you doing it? I don't know. It's really, there's no, what's the goal? Okay, you can say, I want to achieve love for Krishna. But for someone who's achieved love for Krishna, why do they go on chanting the holy names? Why does Mother Yashoda go on cooking for Krishna? When the fact is that Krishna doesn't need anything. What's the goal? No, this is the very definition of what Leela is. This is what Leela means, pastime means. Action that has no goal to it. No goal. Just like you look at Brajamandal Parikrama, this 1 month long walk that you do in Vrindavan, every day you walk from one place to another. Amazingly powerful experience. Walking the dust of Vrindavan, seeing different places of Krishna's pastimes, visiting Radha Kunda. You start off on this month long journey. At the end, how far have you gone? Where have you achieved? Where have you arrived at? The starting point, the same place. What was the point? Okay? It's not goal-oriented action. You're just going in a circle. That's all. Other pilgrimages, they're goal-oriented. I go to the Ganga at Prayag or at Haridwar. You take a dip, get rid of your sins, come back home. Feeling rejuvenated, refreshed. Very nice. Purified. It's goal-oriented pilgrimage. You have a goal in mind. Spiritual activity can be goal-oriented as well. But the highest level of spiritual life, no goal-oriented. That's what the purpose of Rajamandala Parikrama is, to break our minds free of the mode of goal-oriented action and make it Krishna-oriented action, centered upon Krishna. You're going in a circle, and everything you're going around is Krishna, is connected to Krishna. And at the end, you come back exactly to the same space, only to do it again, only to want to do it again in another circle. No matter how many times you go around Govardhan Hill, Govardhan Parikrama, yet again we go in circles. This is the point of Parikrama. You circumambulate the deities. It's unending. You do it again, and you do it again. There's no stop to it. That's the nature of a circle. Because there's no goal. The goal's there already. You're going around the goal, right? It's arrived there. It's Krishna-centered activity, Krishna-oriented activity. And that's the nature of the love of the residents of Vrindavan. It's Krishna-oriented. It's not goal-oriented. Krishna's there, and that's the only thing they need. They have nothing to achieve in this world. And this is why there's this very nice verse which defines Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy in just a little nutshell. You know this verse? Prabhupada quotes it quite often. It comes from the commentary on Srimad Bhagavatam by Srinath Chakravarti Thakur, who was the spiritual master of Kavikarnapura, who was the son of Shivananda Sen, who was a very close associate of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. So he's not very widely known, his work, Srinath Chakravarti Thakur, except for this one verse. It's a beautiful commentary in Bhagavatam, and this verse begins it, because in a little nutshell, it defines Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's philosophy. It puts it in a little, you know, if anyone ever asks you to say, can you summarize, what's distinctive about the spiritual path you follow? Here it is. Aradhyo Bhagavan Brajeshatanayas Taddhama Vrindavanam. Aradhyo Bhagavan Brajeshatanayas Taddhama Vrindavanam. Ramyaka Chidupasana Vrajavadhu Yavargena Yakalpita Ramya Kachit Upasana Vrajavadhu Vargena Yakalpita Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam Prema Pumartho Mahan Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam Prema Pumartho Mahan Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Matamidam Tatradaru Napara Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Matamidam Tatradaru Napara. What is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's viewpoint? Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Matam is this. Aradhyo Bhagavan Brajeshataneya. Number one, our Aradhya or worshipable deity, worshipable Lord, is Brajeshataneya, is the son of the king of Braja. Now notice how this is stated. The object of our worship is the son of the king of Braja. Immediately the point is what? That our object of worship is Krishna, of course, but Krishna is who? Krishna as the son of the king of Braja. In other words, Krishna in Vrindavan. Krishna in Vrindavan. Krishna as the son of Nanda Maharaj. Because Brajesha, you'd expect the statement should be, our worship of the Lord is Krishna, who is the king of X and X. But no. Krishna, who is the son of the king of Vrindavan. So he's not the top man in Vrindavan. He's not the top guy. Immediately that point is clear. The chief person there is Nanda Maharaj. He's the son of the chief. Okay? Nice, still important position, but definitely not number one. Why? Because he's in Vrindavan, Brajeshapanis. Why is that form, the form of Krishna we worship? Because Ramya Kachidupasana Vrajavadhu Vargena Yakalpita. And that form of worship is most Ramya, most pleasing to our Aradhya, our worship of the Lord. What form of worship? Ramya Kachit Upasana Vrajavadhu Vargena Yakalpita. Which is done in the path, following the footsteps, Vargena, of Vrajavadhu, of the ladies of Vrindavan, of the gopis. That path which is done in the footsteps of that worship which comes in the footsteps of the residents of Vrindavan, especially the gopis, that is the most pleasing to Krishna. How do we know this? What's the proof? Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amala. Perhaps you say, well, I don't believe that. In my scripture, it says this form of worship is the best. And this is the form of God you should worship. That's okay. That's okay. No problem. But for us, Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. Our ultimate, purest Pramana, the means, the source of our knowledge, the way we know something is right, is through Srimad Bhagavatam. We all have to have our Pramanas, our sources of knowledge. And there's nothing to say that there has to be only one valid means of Pramana in this world. In fact, there's not. There's multiple sources of Pramana. But we have to choose one Pramana. We have to choose one source of knowledge. We have to decide what our source is. And for followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam. That's our Pramana. That's how we know anything. And what's our goal? Prema Pumartho Mahan. Our ultimate goal is prema. Or love for God. Is it moksha? No. Is it karma? No. Is it jnana? No. It's prema. Pure love. Selfless love. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu Matamidam Tatradharanam. This is the viewpoint of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and nothing else. That's it. So it's actually a very nice verse to keep in mind. Because although stating it in the way I did, perhaps one can only do that in an audience of devotees, the followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu can appreciate this. But there's other ways of describing it in a way which is more widely appreciable. If someone asks you to make a presentation on Krishna consciousness, you can easily just take one of these. For example, Prema Pumartho Mahan, that our ultimate goal is pure love of God. Such a nice theme to speak on. And anyone can appreciate it if we present it in the right way. We obviously wouldn't put it in terms of, you know, the stages of bhakti and bhava and prema, the gopis and residents of Vrindavan. So, but we can still explain why it is that prema, or selfless love, is a higher end, a higher goal than anything else in this world. Because it's selfless. Whereas everything else has selfish motivation, it's pure because it's completely focused on God, on the other. Similarly, we could take Srimad Bhagavatam Pramanam Amalam and talk about what is the source of knowledge and what is scripture. We could take Aradhyo Bhagavan Vrajeshatalayas and discuss the definition of God. What do we mean by God? What is our understanding of God? And there's wonderful ways to get people to appreciate Krishna as God, even if it's difficult to understand all these points about rasa and the different relationships and so forth. But why one would want to worship a God who is primarily someone who's caught up in relationships, who's primarily a relational being, and not some kind of abstract force. We can help others appreciate that point. And so this is... I personally found this a very useful verse to kind of keep in mind and use as a source for, okay, this is who we are. This is our philosophical identity as followers of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This is Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's unique contribution. Every aspect of this verse, each of the points, are pretty much unique, nearly unique to Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And certainly the combination of all of them is unique to him. Others may accept one or the two, but the combination of all of them together is quite unique. So I'll stop at that point, or pause. And at this point, excuse me, if there are any questions or comments, yes, Mother Rukmi.
I have two questions.
Are they related or?
No.
Okay, then maybe one at a time.
Okay. The first question is, you mentioned these Sanskrit meters of chanting and the wonderful names for them.
Yeah.
It makes it so pictorial and so interesting.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, is there an infinite number of such meters? Mm. Is there a finite number? Do you have names for all of them? Or?
Yeah. That's a very nice question. And in fact, it's there's so much there. One could do a whole seminar on just different types of meters and different ways of reciting them. On average, I'd say we encounter on a regular basis maybe 10 meters or so, those that we encounter regularly. But the Sanskrit language itself has hundreds, if not thousands of meters, but at least hundreds of meters. And there's entire books you can find, just like Baladev Vidya Bhushana, one of our acharyas, he wrote a book called Chanda Kaustubha, which means the Kaustubha gem of Chanda, or meters. And in that he gives at least one metrical form for every possible number of syllables. So in other words, in a simple Bhagavad Gita verse, for example, there's 8 syllables per quarter. Right? Dharma kshetre, kuru kshetre is 8. Samaveta yuyutsava, 8 per quarter. So in one line there's 16, because it's usually written in two lines. So you can have verses with 15, or 14, or 13, or 12, or going the other direction, 17, 18, 19, depending on length. The verse in Vasanta Tilaka, this Govinda verse, Govinda Madi Purusham Tamaham Bhajami. How many did I do? 14?
Yeah.
And every line will have the same number of syllables, every line. And so it's a metrical form with 14 syllables. Shad Goswami Ashtaka is yet longer, it's a different length. So he gives one meter, at least one. Chanda, one metrical form for every possible length of syllable, including 1 and 2, which are kind of more theoretical in nature. And then each one, he gives a verse, beautiful verse about Krishna, which he's composed himself as a demonstration of that meter. And then that verse not only is about Krishna in that meter, but the word, the name of that meter, which has a pictorial representation, will be incorporated into the verse that he gives as the example. It will be a word within that verse, which he'll tell as part of the story. So one of my professors in Oxford who was visiting there, his name was Narasimhachari, and he wrote a verse once. He was also a composer in Sanskrit, and he wrote a verse in the meter of Druta Vilambita, which is a meter which means slow fast. Druta means fast, Vilambita means slow. So it's a meter that goes quickly and then slows down. It goes kind of like the one we did, but it's much more prominent. Fast syllables, and then slow, and then fast again, and slow. It has this kind of jerky feel. And so this verse he wrote was about Nanda Maharaj, Vasudev, taking Krishna across the Yamuna after his birth to give to Maharaj Nanda. And in the verse, he expressed Nanda Maharaj, Vasudev's feeling as he's carrying Krishna across the Yamuna. Sometimes he would think, oh my God, Kansa and his people will soon awake, and I better get Krishna out of here and back into my jail cell, whether they return. So he would quicken his step. He would hasten. And then he think, the faster I get there, the more quickly I'll have to part from my child. I'll have to give up Krishna's company. And he'd slow down and he'd start looking at Krishna. And then immediately he'd be struck by fear again, and he'd start moving faster. And so in this way, he moved Druta Vilambita, fast and slow, fast and slow. So that very word was present in the verse, which expressed the mood that was going on in the piece of poetry that he wrote. So that's an example of how an expert poet can take all of these things together and express what they want perfectly in the meter that they want. And that's a very difficult thing to do. We don't have time here to get into the how the poetry is composed. But to compose, to say exactly what you want in the meter you want. Sanskrit meter is a lot more rigid than English meters. English verse. And so there's practically no thing like free verse. And everything is quite... To actually say what you want to say in the meter that you want, that's very difficult. It's a very difficult thing to accomplish. So there's many meters like this, and a very large number. We probably encounter around 10 or so regularly. The Bhagavad Gita short meter is kind of a standard one. The most common, called Anushtup, eight lines, eight syllables to a quarter. And the longer one in Bhagavad Gita, as you find in chapter 11, that's the second most common one. These two you find throughout the Srimad Bhagavatam as well. But then if you go to the 10th canto of Srimad Bhagavatam, you start finding a variety of other meters. I like that famous one with Bhakti, which Bhakti Charuswami sings so beautifully, of the gopis. A song for Krishna, right? Tabakatam bitam tabdai. That one is almost unique in Srimad Bhagavatam. It's rarely found elsewhere. That meter is called Raja Hamsi, which means the king of swans. And it's a very regal meter. In its feel also, you kind of Tabakatam bitam tabdajivanam kavibhiriditam kalmashapaham shravanamangalam shri. You can just imagine a swan. They're the way they glide, this way, and then that way, and this way, neck held high. It's a very regal, Raja Hamsi. It's a swan, but the king of swans. They have some leadership, some control over their pond. I've seen this actually in New Vrindavan. They have a couple swans in that pond, and they're very graceful, but when another bird or even a boat tries to take their space, they'll chase him out. They'll chase him away. They zip behind it. They're Raja Hamsi. They're king swans, you know, just not any swan. So that meters that. Then in the Shikshashtaka, this meter... which one is it? Oh. Nayanam galada shudharaya vadanam gadgadarudhaya gira pulakai nichitam vapukada tapanama grahane bhavishyati. If you recite this meter carefully, you'll notice there's something a little odd about it. it doesn't quite fit into any melody that we sing. We kind of end up packing a few syllables into it. Nayana mangalada shudhare, you have to catch. And the reason for that is because this meter is called Vyogini, which means a woman who's separated from her lover. Vyogini. Now, what's the mood of the whole verse? Of so many of these verses. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is feeling intense separation from Krishna in the mood of Srimati Radha. And what makes this meter give its distinctive quality, Vyogini, is that one line has 11 syllables, the next one has 10. Then 11, then 10. And so it doesn't quite fit. You get to the, you do the 11 line properly, then you go to the next line, and it's like something's missing. It's a syllable short. There's a very odd quality about it. And then again there's something more. And then again there's something missing. And it's this really, it's a sense of unsettlement when you recite the meter. Meters, these verses affect us in a very deep way, whether we understand the technicalities or not. Poetry and rhythm is something that goes to the deepest reaches of who, what human beings are. And we'll be affected by it, whether or not we understand it. I mean, forget the effect of the spiritual sound vibration. I'm just saying, forget the effect of the metrical pattern. Because we're hardwired as human beings to feel rhythm, to feel sound, to feel verse. And so that one has a very unsettling mood to it. Something's wrong. Something's upset. There's something missing. Oh, in fact, there's something missing. Every other line has a syllable missing.
So this is not my second question, but okay. What was the name of the tiger one?
Oh, Shardula Vikriditam. Okay, S-A-R-D-U-L-A. That's the first word, Shardula. It's a compound word, so you can put a dash after that. Vikriditam. V-I-K-R-I-D-I-T-A-M. Vikriditam. Shardula means tiger. Vikridita means play.
So my next question is, even before you mentioned the little anecdote with your student, I was thinking while you were speaking that I wanted to ask if you could tell some anecdotes about your teaching, your students. How are they hearing? How are they appreciating? Any kind of anecdotes, from your studies or from your teaching, interaction with students?
It's actually a great pleasure teaching students about Hinduism, because there's so much one can do there, and of course, it's up to the professor what you want to emphasize and what you want to focus on. You kind of find a range of students, those who are in it simply to satisfy requirements, some are there just to pass the course. But there's always a group within that who are genuinely interested in the subject, in the topic. And over the course of the semester, it's wonderful to see the very real ways in which their understanding of God grows, of spiritual life grows. As a professor in an academic context, I'm not able to say this is the truth and you should accept it. That I can't do. That's the role of a teacher in a religious context. And in an academic context, we have to maintain some measure of distance from what it is we study, so that students don't feel that they're being preached at. My goal is to present our topic of study in as genuine and authentic a light as possible, to get them to try to, so that they can appreciate, they can understand what's going on. But one of the things that I've kind of come to realize the most, which has been really a nice experience for me, is that the content of Krishna consciousness, the content of our scriptures and of our philosophy, is so pure and so naturally attractive to a person that you don't even almost have to tell them that this is the truth and you should accept it. In other words, that if I can just present it as authentically as possible, the students see that, okay, this is something that the professor is really invested in. This is something that means a lot. And those who are ready for it, not everyone, but those who are at that level, they become naturally drawn towards it. Krishna is all attractive, you know? And it stands out because there's so many things I have to talk about. We discuss Mayavad philosophy, we talk about Shankara's viewpoint, we talk about all kinds of practices in Hinduism that, as Vaishnavas, we would not agree with or accept. But it's okay. It's like it doesn't matter. If we truly feel that this philosophy is self-evident, like Prabhupada says so many times, it's self-evident, swata pramana. It's like the sun. It illuminates itself. No one has to say, where is the sun? Point it out. No, it's self-evident. You can see it. You don't need to hold a light up to us, up to the sun. I've realized that, okay, it's okay. You know, if I can't go ahead and say to these people directly that this is the truth, if they're ready for it, they'll see it. If they're ready for it, they'll see it. And I can help them get there by encouraging them to broaden their perspective. Like discussions about God, for example, viewpoints of God. Over the course of the semester, in this course on gods and goddesses, we start off with studying creation, stories of creation. We talk about Sankhya and different systems of creation. We talk about Mahavishnu on the ocean. We talked about Lord Shiva's role as the father of the creation and so forth. But then from creation, we move on to Leela, to pastime. And the students move in their view, in their concept, in their understanding of God. Oh, it's possible that God could do action that is not goal-oriented because he has nothing to achieve. And there are moments like that which really provide kind of the satisfaction of the job when you see that happen. One time a student came into my office and I assign, in my Intro to Hinduism course, I assign Prabhupada's Gita. And I give them certain chapters to read. And I just say, read the translations, because I can't give them too much reading, and for most of them the purports are too much to handle at that point. But this student came to my office once and said, you know, Professor, you assigned chapters this and this and this, and I just couldn't stop reading. I read the whole thing. And will you ever offer a course on Bhagavad Gita? That'd be so nice to study. And other students who said, you know, you assign the translations, but in order to do the writing assignment properly, I figured I'd have an advantage if I read the purports. And they'll go ahead and read the purports. And in fact, their understanding is much better. I mean, it's a fact. Their papers are better, it's no doubt. I'm not sure exactly the direction of the question you were going in, but that's, I guess, in terms of presentation of Krishna consciousness, one thing I realized is that there's many ways of presenting Krishna consciousness. And this format is a very effective means. But the nature of Krishna is such that if we truly believe he's all attractive, and if we can be proper conduits for presenting Krishna, then any situation in which we place Krishna in that situation, in the center of it, it's going to turn out to be a preaching activity. It's going to turn out to change people's hearts. People are going to be attracted to Krishna. However you introduce Krishna into the situation, if it's done genuinely and in a favorable light, then a person will accept it. One doesn't necessarily have to present it in one particular mold or manner, because sometimes it's just not possible. If I want to continue this type of work, I just can't present it in a certain way. I'd lose my job in no time. Right? But it's okay. Krishna's there, right? So Krishna's all attractive. And in fact, I remember one time with Tamal Krishna Maharaj. One time when I visited him in Cambridge when he was doing his PhD there, his PhD work was on Srila Prabhupada, and it's due to be published in the near future. Studying something from an academic perspective means doing it with a critical eye, evaluating the success and failures and appropriateness and this and that. It's a pretty it's not the parampara system of learning, to put it that way. And so I asked him, I said, Maharaj, how do you do this with your own spiritual master? Right? Of all places, we hear in front of a spiritual master, you must always remain a fool. Right? And of all persons, Srila Prabhupada, how do you do that? And Maharaj, he said, you know, you're right. It's the most painful experience I've ever gone through in my life. It's so painful to put your spiritual master through the rigmarole of academic study. Why, as a disciple, would I want my guru to go through this? But I do it simply because I have the firm conviction that if Srila Prabhupada is who I believe he is, who I have firm faith that he is, then he will come out the other end looking just as glorious as when he went in. In fact, more glorious, because his glory will be shown in a place, in a light that hasn't been shown before. And I thought, wow. That's, I mean, he was doing, saying it in terms of his dissertation, but that's a way to approach life in general. That's a way to approach our role as devotees in general. We find ourselves in so many contexts, and not in every context can we tell others about Krishna in the same way. Can we be a devotee in the same way? But that's okay. Right? We have to go into that circumstance with a firm conviction that if Krishna is who he is, and if Prabhupada is who he is, then what's the problem? Why am I afraid? If I present Krishna in this circumstance, if I make him a factor of this equation, then he will show his true colors. He will attract everyone, as he does. So whether it be academic work, or whether it be a job we're going as an engineer or a computer programmer, or whether it's pujari work we're doing, or whatever it might be. But trying to present Krishna as he is in that circumstance, well, Krishna is bound to attract the hearts of anyone who's there. Because of who he is. Not because necessarily of the context, but because of who Krishna is. Is that okay? Gopal, did you have your hand up?
No, I just, you can also tell about the versions of the Gita, the experience that you had when you were...
One of the writing assignments I gave them a couple semesters ago was we read two translations of the Gita. One is an academic translation, and one is Prabhupada's translation. And I explain it very openly to them. There's no kind of underhanded... You can't do that because, you know, people are intelligent. Openly. This is the most widely read edition of the Bhagavad Gita amongst practitioners of the Gita. That's a fact. Right? It's the most widely read edition in the West, most definitely. And it's done from a genuine tradition of sampradaya, okay? From a line of disciplic succession. Here is an academic translation. This author has no commitment to the text or what it teaches, but is very well versed in the language and in the approach and the historical context and everything, and is trying to present it in as objective a manner as possible, at least trying not to convince you of anything. Whereas this author is trying to convince you of the meaning of the Bhagavad Gita. Okay. So here's the practitioner's perspective, here's the academic perspective, and they read both. And then in one assignment, I asked them to compare as part of an essay question in the exam. It's a take-home essay question. Compare and contrast both translations of the Bhagavad Gita. And it's amazing what students come up with. The ways in which they appreciate Prabhupada's Gita. It's like, I feel like they're preaching to me sometimes. It's just the different ways in which they appreciate it. I thought, I never thought of that. That's a really nice point of how they say it seems that the academic writer is sticking very closely to the Sanskrit, but Prabhupada is far more poetic, and this person seems to be have a deep conviction that is conveyed through his writing. And you in their writing, you see that they're affected by that conviction that Prabhupada is conveying. Like, they're not exactly sure at this level what he's saying. It takes a little time to understand, especially the Gita is a very difficult text to digest on the first go, you know? So they're not exactly sure what tradition he's part of. They're just starting to learn the difference between persons and persons. But they appreciate, they're affected by Prabhupada's conviction. And one girl even said, you know, if I had to choose which one to follow, if I was a practitioner, I'd definitely be choosing Prabhupada's translation. Because it seems like a translation you could live your life by, as opposed to the other one, which you just... You know, so just different ways of, okay, yes, there's a difference, right? But this is what's unique, this is what's wonderful about Prabhupada's translation. Vinaya, do you remember any of the other comments? I can't remember specific things. Oh, they adopt the language,
yeah,
isn't it, also?
Yeah. It just makes sense to them. They're like, you know, the goal of life is to surrender to Krishna.
Yeah.
According to the Gita.
And some of the students are actually very sweet. They say things like, well, I think Prabhupada's translation is better because the whole purpose of the Gita anyway is to surrender to Krishna, and Prabhupada makes that point very clearly. And if Krishna consciousness is the goal of the Gita, then don't you see it more clearly in Prabhupada's translation? And the sweet thing about it is, of course, where they get that from is from Prabhupada's translation. In class, like I said, I can't tell them that the purpose of the Gita is to become a devotee of Krishna. All I can say is that Vaishnavas believe that the purpose of the Gita is to become a devotee of Krishna. There's a difference there. Okay? But they come out convinced after reading Prabhupada's Gita. So anyway, it's
also,
nice.
Also, one time after you had assigned Prabhupada's chapter from Prabhupada's Gita, then the student comes in your office and says, oh, what, do you want to convert us?
Hmm.
And it was just one of the many readings, five or six readings, but because it has such a powerful effect, they have to respond to it.
Yeah, that's a fact. Prabhupada's Gita has a powerful effect on the reader. And no one can choose not to be moved by it. In other words, even if you're... you know, some people have a hard time handling it, but that's okay too. I mean, there's no neutral response to Prabhupada's Gita. That oh, it's just I don't know. You know, it's either affected by it or you're. I can't deal with it. I can't handle it. Who else had their hand up? Yes.
Yeah, I had a comment in regards to the Achintya Bheda Ved Tattva. We have a. Jehovah's Witness coming to our home, and my brother normally talks to them.
Hmm.
And one day, you know, they were discussing about the philosophy, and they had the conception of God, and like, so my brother argued that like if God is ultimately the most complex, then to approach Him should also be like more than one, and it has to be more complex, and then they end up with this Achintya. Conception, because it's if God is inconceivable, then it has to be inconceivable, you know, like you cannot understand Him. So like, as you said, like monotheism, one God, that's it, that's understandable. Polytheism, many gods, each has its individual task, that's understandable. But like, how is this understandable?
Right.
Like, so that's what makes it God, you know?
Exactly. That's part of it. If it were possible to fully conceive of God, then it would mean that we were God, right? Because if you can wrap your head around something completely, then it means that you are superior to that person because you have understood them. I mean, the mind has fully enveloped that thing. So what makes us superior to computers is that no matter how complicated they are, someone can pull it apart and understand every aspect of how it works. Right? That's what makes us superior to even the most complicated computer. So if you could do that with God, take him apart, understand every aspect of him and show how he works and how and what he does and why he does it, then by definition he would not be God. You've got the wrong guy. Right? Then you have to go look for God somewhere else. Because God by definition has to be someone whom when you try to figure him out, you end up confused. That's exactly. And this is why the Gyanis' approach is fundamentally flawed. Because It's not fundamentally flawed. It ultimately comes to the point. It should come to the point of realization. Oh, achintya. Okay, I got to stop now. So if this person is inconceivable, then what's the next step? Well, perhaps I should enter into a relationship with that person. If you can't envelope conceive of someone, then might as well have a relationship with them. That's better. Yes, Prabhu.
In your lecture, you covered about Gita and you mentioned about Karma Kanda and other things. In Gita, we all know that of all the yoga system, Bhakti Yoga is the topmost and it's the highest yoga. But Krishna also mentions about more in detail on the Karma Yoga and Jnana Yoga and so on and so forth. So why is not that, why should we, since Bhakti Yoga is the highest, why should we even refer to other yoga? So why did Bhagavad Gita have the explanation on all the other things?
Yeah, good question. Why does the Bhagavad Gita explain all these other yogas if Bhakti Yoga is the highest? Because we're all at different levels and we all have different natures and we like different approaches. And so, you know, just like the PhD is the highest degree, right? So why do BAs exist? Why do people do BAs and MAs and why do they go to grade school? Why can't we just shut down elementary schools and shut down undergraduate schools and just have PhD programs, if that is the highest? Because, yes, that's true, but there's a process for getting there. This is Prabhupada describes as the yoga ladder. There's a method for getting there. And yes, by Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's mercy, we can enter into the process of bhakti very early on. But that's specifically due to his special mercy. That's not typical. You know, the common way of doing it is to do karma, kanda for a couple lifetimes, then do jnana kanda. And maybe we've even done it, we don't know. Right? But do jnana kanda and then come to that. This is the acharyas explaining their commentary on Vedanta Sutra. They say, when it says atato brahma jignyasa, now let us inquire into the absolute truth, it means that you've already studied and performed all the rituals in the Karmakanda section of the Vedas. And now, therefore, that you're exhausted with all of that, and you know that it cannot give you permanent happiness, let us inquire into the absolute truth. That's how they explain that word, now, atha. Now when? After you've done all of that, now you can do it. You see what I mean? So, it's Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's special mercy that we have entrance into the path of bhakti, and we appreciate its significance practically from the start. But that's not typical. So I promise we go till 12:30. If there's one more question, I can take it. Mataji, in the back, all the way.
First of all, person, I really enjoyed the seminar, and every point you touched upon is really great. One of the things I want to understand from you is, what is your approach? Or I should say, maybe I know that I face that challenge a lot, and I want to understand from you what your approach would be, because we do a lot of interfaith work here. We also have association here. We're meeting on a regular basis with all the other temples, like the Swami Narayan Temple, or Mandal Mandir, or Shiva Vishnu Temple, you know, people raised from there. And it's, most of the times, I would say, it's so much harder to convey the message of, you know, Krishna being the supreme to them than it is to the Western people I meet in my work life or the outside world. And what is your approach in dealing with the two different groups of people? I know Prabhupada always used to make this comment, it's easier to wake up a person who's actually sleeping rather than trying to wake up someone who's pretending to be asleep. And I remember that all the time when I'm, you know, interacting with that group of people. But what is your approach to it, and how can we handle that better in preaching more to the people who are born in different ways?
Right. Yeah, it's a good question. We can begin by getting them to agree or understand or appreciate the fact that God is a person. Okay, if we get to that level, we've done 90% of it, really. Because if you look at the way Prabhupada teaches, the way he lectures, this is the point that he's making over and over again in relation to God. And that is the biggest problem that exists today, whether it's amongst the Hindu community or the non-Hindu community, is various forms of impersonalist understanding. So for someone who's completely absorbed in materialism, the basic principle is we have to understand who our recipient is and try to encourage them to rise in their understanding, okay, to the next step. If we meet a child who's just beginning first grade and we try to understand them, try to explain the wonders of calculus, we're in for frustration and the child is not going to like us. Okay? Our relationship with the child will be damaged. But if someone has just finished a course on algebra and trigonometry and you introduce them to calculus, they can appreciate it. So our first job, as the job of any teacher, and this is what preachers are teachers. So the job of any teacher is to first understand the audience. Who am I talking to? And if our audience is at the level of, if our audience is completely absorbed in day-to-day material activities with no time for spiritual life, then just getting them to understand the fact that spirituality is important and we are the spirit soul and there's a higher ultimate spiritual reality, that is a big step for them. And this is why you see Prabhupada, when he is giving general lectures, one of the points he'll always hit upon is, you're not the body, you're the soul. That's a huge step. Now, someone who's already convinced that spiritual life is the essence of life and that we are spirit souls, this is our nature, then to get them to come to a Paramatma conception, I haven't read this. My spiritual master says that he heard Prabhupada say that if we can, in the academic world, for example, if we can get people to the level of Paramatma understanding, that's sufficient. That's very good. That's about as far as you can get on the platform of jnana. You can become Brahman realized perfectly, but to understand that there's some Lord within the heart who's more than abstract, that's, you can just about get there by the power of your intellect. Okay, so someone who's convinced about spiritual life, getting them to understand the presence of God in everything, appreciate everything as the energy of the Lord, the material world, as his energy, and the Lord is present within his energy, that's a major step. And for someone who already sees the world and God in that way, to get them to appreciate that God is a person, that's a huge accomplishment. And once you've come to that point, that God is a person with whom we can have a relationship, they're Vaishnavas. Prabhupada himself said that they're Vaishnava. Someone who believes in a personal God who needs to be worshipped as a Vaishnava. Now, they may get the conception of that God wrong. Krishna says, Aviti Purva. They may get it improperly. So if they already appreciate that God is a person, then yes, that we can engage with them in conversation about what the nature of that person should be. Okay? He has to be relational. He can't, describing him as creator is nice, but it's not the ultimate thing. Why would God want to spend his time creating? Could he not delegate that task to others? What does he like to spend his time doing? Well, perhaps it's in lila or in relationships. Look at the nature of Krishna. Of all the forms of Godhead, it's only Krishna who shows every possible kind of relationship. If you look at the spectrum of Hindu deities, it's a fact. No one shows every single type of relationship possible other than Krishna. Whether it's married love or it's unmarried love or it's formal friendship or informal friendship, or whether it's as a child or whether it's as a parent or it's as a ruler or it's as a subject, right? Everything. So if God is fundamentally relational, then doesn't Krishna fit the bill pretty nicely? So my point is, see where your audience is at and try to move them to the next level of understanding. This is why we have the idea of Brahman, Paramatma, and Bhagavan. Because they're all the same thing, but we have to encourage people to move higher at each step. And people will appreciate it. People in general like to be challenged. They like to be pulled. I mean, agreement with everything is very boring. And people get bored with you if you agree with them all the time. It's very actually distasteful, someone who always agrees with you. No, people like to be challenged. They like to be contradicted even. But it has to be this much. Right? It has to be this much. You can't go out here in left field and say, okay, here's the ultimate truth, now accept it. No, it's too much. Someone who already accepts Krishna, they can begin appreciating, okay, what form of Krishna, right? Like we're discussing here. In what mood? And then, you see what I mean? So, that it's the same process we do with each other, we do with ourselves. Is it's a constant process of initiation. That's what spiritual life is. It's a constant process of initiation, of being initiated. We go through first initiation, we go through second initiation, and we think that's it. Right? It's over. Oh no, maybe sannyas. Okay, now it's it. No, but fourth initiation, fifth, sixth, seventh, 256th initiation. It means, initiation means where, under the guidance of the spiritual master, a new level of our service is facilitated. We're introduced to a new level of seva, or service. So that's our job as preachers. That's our job as teachers, is to introduce people to a new understanding of Krishna, a deeper understanding of Krishna. You see what I mean? This is what Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says, Jare dekho tare koho Krishna upadesh, amara jnay guru haiya taro udesh. Right? You're acting as guru by introducing someone to a new dimension of Krishna. That, oh, you understood Krishna is present everywhere. That's nice. But could he not be a person? You've just acted in the role of guru by adding that dimension. Okay? So, seeing it in that way, sometimes taking the full conception and putting it on someone is a very difficult thing for someone to digest. Does that make sense?
No, I'm still confused.
Okay.
On the approach part, and then maybe I can talk to you a little bit later and you can help me understand my group.
Sure. If there's a particular group you have in mind or a very specific audience, then perhaps we can spend some time afterwards and discuss that individually. It's the beginning of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's like the, it's literally the fourth or fifth verse, or third or fourth or fifth verse of Chaitanya Charitamrita. It's right there at the beginning.
And another one, Aradhyam Bhagwan Vrajeshapanam.
That you can look up in Prabhupada's books. He quotes the verse often in different pieces, in different lines. But Srinath Chakravarti Thakur's commentary on Bhagavatam is not published, as far as I know. I don't recall. Prabhupada quotes it in different lectures at different times. But if you do a Vedabase search for even a couple of the verses, you'll come up with many references. He quotes it quite often. So, oh, okay. Prabhupada, please. I can do it quickly.
So, do you have opportunity to go to, like, or deal with interfaith? The question was raised before. And what is your, what would be the approach appropriate to deal with other religious sects, Muslims or Christians, or
yeah.
Sometimes it's like, it's actually a sin to worship God in the personal form. So, how do we deal with that? With them, so they can become intolerant.
So the question is, what is the approach, what would be my approach to interfaith work if I participate in that, and how should we approach members of other faiths? This is actually a wonderful question. It's quite a large question also to address in a satisfactory way. I'll just say something really brief here. For one thing, I engage in interfaith work. All of it is thanks to Anuttama Prabhu and Mother Rukmini, who've been engaging me in various ways in that regard. And so, to get a thorough, detailed answer, I think they would be the experts you'd want to talk to them about. But in terms of my own experience, I found kind of, you see people engaging in interfaith work at different levels. One, it's sometimes people do it, we should talk to members of other faiths so we can preach to them and show them how ours is superior, and maybe even they'll become devotees, we'll convert them. Right? That form of interfaith work is not very useful. It can actually be hurtful, because for someone who's convinced and following God in a particular path, then why disturb them and hurt them in that way, when there's plenty of others to speak to if you know what I mean? I mean, why target someone who's already satisfied? A second approach can be for the purposes of getting along with others, that we want to live peacefully, and we want to live in a tolerant community. And so we should know our neighbors, and we should engage with them and see what they have to say. Right? So it's relationship building, and it's building communities and smoothing out differences and like that. And that's a very laudable aim of interfaith work. And then yet another stage you find for interfaith work in which there's a genuine desire on both sides or on all sides to learn from the other. That actually there is something that there may be another way in which I can appreciate Krishna by seeing how Christians appreciate Jesus or by seeing how Muslims appreciate Allah. Because if Krishna is God and this path is genuine, as Prabhupada says it is, or these scriptures are genuine, then clearly they understand the Lord in some way, and they understand my Lord in some way. They understand Krishna in some way. So then I can also learn something about Krishna from their experience. Of course, to do this takes, one has to be very secure in one's own practice of Krishna consciousness. Because the reason it's often difficult to do this is because one can feel threatened. Oh, I'm learning from them. Does that mean they're better? Should I become a Christian? No. One has to be very secure. I worship Krishna in the mood of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. This is who I am. But because of that very fact, because Krishna encompasses everything in existence, so why can I not appreciate Krishna in this way? Just like I can go to Yellowstone National Park and appreciate Krishna through the natural beauty there. So why can I not appreciate Krishna in some other way? Right? In another aspect, in another way in which he's related. So there's different kind of approaches or levels to interfaith work, depending on on our reasons for getting into it. Okay, thank you very much. Thank you all very much for participating, and once again, my sincere thanks to the devotees.